our speaker comes to us from the Philadelphia Group. And our speaker tonight is Greg. Please help me welcome.
Hi guys, my name is Greg Dopkin and I'm an alcoholic. I'm happy to be here tonight. I'm happy to be sober. Man, it's a lot of people pouring in at like 10 after 8. I wasn't always happy to be sober. You know, I wasn't always like enthusiastic about sobriety. As a matter of fact, I thought it was something that would be like a sentence from a judge. They call it probation. It's okay guys, you can laugh a little bit. I want to welcome the new guy, John, you know, with 5 days. I think that's great, you know, and I don't think that there's anywhere better for a guy like, John or myself than a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and, I'm somebody who is absolutely, I'm completely head over heels in love with AA, you know, and at some point or another during my boring, miserable, depressing sobriety, something happened to me, right? And like, we call it a spiritual experience or like a psychic change, and that's exactly what happened to me. It gave me a real shot at life, you know. And at some point or another, my perception started to change. And I started to completely just fall in love with you guys. I completely fell in love with what we were doing together in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I started to fall in love with going to the meetings and showing up early and making the coffee. And I started to fall in love with going to the detox commitments and the jails and going out and sharing my story and going out and watching other people share their story. And at some point or another, somebody took me through the 12 steps, right? I don't think that my story is any different than anybody else in this room, right? I lived a boring, depressing, miserable life. I come to AA. I'm completely broken. I've knocked over the house of cards again. And I'm completely convinced that I'm not capable of staying sober. I could always get sober. I could never stay sober. And somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous comes in and saves my life. You know, somebody comes in doing exactly what we're supposed to do, looking for new people that they can be of service to. And they grab me up and they start to share their story. And they start to like share a little bit of experience and some of their strength. And I start to feel some hope in my heart. And at some point or another, they take me through the steps and I'm able to, at that point, use these 12 steps as tools to be able to go out and be of service to everybody else. And, especially in AA. And we have like such a beautiful way of doing that. You know, when we go out and we share our experience with other people, where, I'm convinced that like this is like a room full of people that like we very well should be dead, you know, and here we get like a real shot, not just of like, you know, a normal life. You know what I mean? Like my whole life, like I just wanted to be like normal. At some point or another, like I decided that like I had some kind of like strange psychological disorder that like nobody was going to be able to put their finger on. And when I died, they were going to name it after me. And that wasn't the case. You know, somebody sat me down in Alcoholics Anonymous and started to explain to me that they had the same brand of crazy. Ooh, as I did. And it changed my life. It changed my life forever. I have a sponsor. He knows that he sponsors me. That's kind of like a first. And he'll always say to me too, he'll be like, you know, Greg, before I started sponsoring you, I had a full head of hair. And I'll be like, well, maybe if you prayed a little bit more, you wouldn't lose so much hair when you picked up the phone. Guys, come on. It's a joke. You guys, it's okay to laugh. I have a home group, and I think it's probably like the best home group. I'm completely in love with my home group, and it's the best home group that anybody could ever have. And if you're not completely in love with your home group, there's plenty of groups in Alcoholics Anonymous that you can find, and I'm sure there's one that you'll fall in love with, you know. And I've had the opportunity to watch this group just like completely just like flourish, and it's been like such a cool experience. And all the people that we've started this group with, they all turn into like our family, and it's just like such a beautiful thing. And like I wouldn't rather be doing anything else in the world, you know. When we started this group, I made a decision that all the other groups were doing it wrong, you know. But it's only because like I'm so in love with like what we're doing in Alcoholics Anonymous together. And I have a sobriety date. It's June 10th, 2010. I've been happily, comfortably, serenely sober for the past 4 years, you know, and that wasn't my story. You know, I'm the guy who can't stay sober. You know, I'm a chronic relapser. I'm a guy who doesn't think that like there's any hope. You know, I remember sitting in a rehab and I'm looking, I'm in this detox, and and it's like a metal. I'm in the bathroom, and everything is like metal. The sink is metal. The shower is metal. And I guess it was so they could like hose everything off after like everybody just pukes their guts everywhere. And I remember like looking in the mirror thinking to myself, like, man, I better get used to this. You know, because I was so convinced that I was not capable of staying sober. I was completely convinced, you know. I would take like a sip of my dad's beer every now and then. I remember one time my dad had a screwdriver. I thought it was orange juice. I took a huge gulp. I probably got a little drunk. I was 7 years old, you know what I mean? And ran around the house. I was doing armpit farts and being obnoxious and good times. And I do remember, like, you know, I grew up. I had like a little silver spoon in my stuck up my butt. I had everything I ever wanted or needed as a kid. And you know, I had two loving parents, and we grew up in a $700,000 home in Morristown, New Jersey. And one thing I will say is, like, I remember like feeling like this feeling of like separation or like disconnection from the other people around me from like a pretty young age, you know. And I didn't feel like I quite fit in, you know. And some people call it like a round peg in a square hole, or maybe I was born on the wrong planet or something. And like I identify with that, you know. And I didn't have like a necessarily bad childhood. The worst thing about my childhood was that it happened to me. You know, if it happened to you, I would tell you to get over it, but it happened to me. So, you know, I grow up and I remember like I'm in like grade school, and I remember like I'm the new kid in school. My parents, we moved around a little bit when I was a kid, and I'm the new kid in school, and I'm sitting at the lunch table, and I'm sitting there with my book or my Game Boy or whatever. I was never a big reader. And, I'm like looking at this group of kids, right, across the room, and they're all like having like such a great time. They're all like getting along, and they're joking, and they're laughing, and they're talking about girls or cooties or whatever we talk about when we're like that young. And I remember like thinking to myself, like, man, I wish I could just like sit down with those people. I wish I could just like be a part of that. You know, I always wanted to be a part of something. And I do remember like thinking, like, man, I wish I just had the balls to just get up and walk over there and sit my butt down and start talking to these kids. And I never did it. You know, I grew up, and I was a kid who I would eat paste, and I would stick crayons up my nose. And, guys, it's okay. That's supposed to be funny. I felt like that kid, you know what I mean? Like, I felt like that kid for like my whole life, you know, for a long time. I felt like that reputation followed me. So, you know, I get a little older, and I start to have like some like pretty early experiences with alcohol, and I'm not even in high school yet, you know, and there are these kids, they're a little bit older than I am. And I don't think it's very like, I'm no like special snowflake. You know what I mean? I ran around with the wrong crowd, just like a lot of other people when we were young. And these kids, like, they, for some reason or another, they have like a little bit of an interest in me, and I have an interest in doing the things that they were doing. And one of these kids, his name was Casey. He sleeps at my house one night. And, I remember this like crystal clear, you know what I mean? And, I remember like we're sitting there and we're talking, and he's talking about like doing drugs and drinking and this, that, the other, smoking cigarettes. And he's like, I'm like, do you want to get drunk? And he's like, yeah, man, I want to get drunk. Are you kidding me? Let's get drunk. So we go into my parents' freezer, and we pull out a bottle of Stoli, and we make Kool-Aid. So what we do is we pour in the vodka, and then we pour in the Kool-Aid powder and just mix it. And it was disgusting. But you know, I remember watching this kid, right? We're sitting on my parents' kitchen on the island, and I remember like he picks up this cup, and it was a little, like, it was like a kid cup. It was like a little plastic, the ones where you can put the lid on it just in case we knock it over. And I watch him, and he takes a drink, right? And I proceed to take a drink. And I don't think that, like, up to this point, I don't think the fact that, like, I took that drink makes me an alcoholic. I don't think the fact that I offered to go steal some vodka and seek some adventure makes me an alcoholic. I think that just makes me a little bit of an insecure kid who kind of wants to fit in a little bit, you know, and who looks up to somebody. I looked up to this kid, and I wanted to do what he did. You know, I wanted him to like me. And I don't know if it was like after the first drink or the second drink. I don't know exactly when it happened. At some point or another, I was sitting down when I took that drink, and I stood up. And I don't know if anybody else is like taking a drink sitting down, and then they stand up. But you happen to catch a little buzz, and that's exactly what happened to me. You know, I caught a buzz. You know, and all of a sudden, I go from like this kid who picks his nose and sticks crayons up his nose and eats paste, and nobody wants to be around me. And my mind, right, that's just like completely, it's just like racing. And the wheels are turning, and I go from being this kid who can't stop the wheels from turning in his head, and I'm thinking to myself, this kid doesn't like me, I don't know what he wants to, why he's even over here, and I'm not good enough, and I'm just like completely consumed with like this fear and this anxiety. And all of a sudden, I drink all that away like that. And all of a sudden, Casey and I were like brothers, and we're laughing, and we're joking, and we're hanging out. And it turns out to be like a lot of fun. And I don't know if it was like right then and there, or if it was some point in the near future from that point in time. But like I had made a decision that like that was how I was going to deal with like the rest of this world and its people. You know, and by the time I took that first drink, it was like the most amazing thing that had ever happened to me. Right? Because I had this problem, and it was this racing mind and this restless irritability and discontent, and I could drink all of it away, you know, and I chased that, and I chased that as far as I could. So I get to a point, you know, you fast forward a little bit, and I'm not even in high school yet still, and, you know, I'm standing outside of a mall in Morristown, New Jersey, and I'm talking to somebody, and this person, I don't know this person from like a can of paint. I've never met the guy before. We're having like a little conversation. And at some point or another, he turns to me and goes, "You want to go get high?" And I'm like, "Dude, let's go, man." And because I knew. And it wasn't because like I was trying to like seek adventure. It wasn't because I was like trying to party. It was because like I knew like deep down inside that like at some point or another, like I was going to get high and I was going to smoke that joint and I was going to get right, you know, and I was going to feel like everything was going to be okay. It was like the easiest breath I've ever taken, you know. So I hop on a bus, and I take this bus 40 minutes to a part of town that I didn't think was as nice as, you know, the neighborhood with the million-dollar homes that I grew up in, and we proceed to get high. And essentially what I do is I run away from home. I get back, and I'm so embarrassed about what's happened because I know, like, you know, I know all about, like, don't run around with strangers and don't, you know, I know all that. You know, I'm not a dumb kid. Well, I'm not necessarily a smart kid either, but they always said, "Greg, make sure you always just dress well," or something. I don't know. and I get home. I'm so embarrassed that like this story that I make up, this fabricated story, like the truth would have been more believable than like what I told everybody. And you know, you fast forward a little bit after that, and I'm getting arrested, you know, and I'm not even in high school, and I'm standing outside of this mall in Morristown, New Jersey, the same mall, and I'm running around to all these girls, and I'm asking them these like ridiculous, "Can I see your thong?" and "Can I see your nipples?" and like these like just completely like outlandish things. They didn't think it was very appropriate, right? And so I'm sitting in the back seat of this paddy wagon, and my parents are coming up, and they're letting me go home, thank God. And I can hear my parents fighting, and my mom screaming at my dad screaming at my mom, how did you let him go out and do this? And my dad's like, "I don't know, he just left, you know, and I wouldn't have done any of that stuff had I not taken a drink or six that night. And what ends up happening to me, this is like the first time I make a firm resolution, right, that I'm going to stop drinking. I absolutely, and I mean it with everything that I have. Like I'm done, and every bone in my body is screaming, like, "I'm going to stay sober and I'm not going to drink." And I write my dad this letter, and it's like so apologetic and like heart touching. And it says like, "I will go anywhere you want me to go, and I will do anything you tell me to do. Just please, I can't do this, you know, and I'm so young." So he takes that letter, he sends me to a boarding school, and I make another firm resolution that like I'm going to stop drinking, right? And I go out, and I get they had a dress code where you had to wear ties and stuff. So I go out to Joseph A. Banks, and I get all these like nice dress clothes, and I'm like turning over a new leaf, right? And I make it in this boarding school, and I'm maybe like a week, maybe less in there. And I find some kids that want to get right, just like I do, you know, and I get right. Because my experience is that when you take the drugs and alcohol away from somebody like me, that's not my problem. You know, that's my solution. So you take my solution, you take my answer away from me. And now we have like a real serious problem, and I will do anything that I can to try and get right. So, you fast forward a little bit, and like I'm in this boarding school, and most of the kids, their disciplinary system, it was a demerit system, right? So most kids, they'll graduate 4 years of high school in this private school with anywhere between 5 and 15 demerits. My first year, I had 237 demerits, and the second year, they're holding a hearing to decide whether or not they're going to let poor little me stay. And, you know, some very unreasonable teachers thought it was a good idea to start drug testing me and to start searching my room. And I'll tell you what, they weren't happy with what they found. And my second year, I'm getting kicked out of high school, you know, and that shoots me off into this. And, like, I'll tell you what, from the point, when I got to that boarding school and I got high with those kids, like, from that point on, for a long time, like, I wasn't going to draw another sober breath. And I didn't know it at the time, you know. Nobody told me that, like, Greg, when you start drinking, you don't stop. You know? So, I'm kicked out of this boarding school, and here we are again, like, with another firm resolution. This time I go to American Eagle, I buy every collared shirt in the store. Can I just take you guys back for just, like, 1 second? And, I just want to talk about, like, 14-year-old me. Here I am, 14 years old. I have this afro that's just, like, out to here, and I had these, like, anybody ever go to Hot Topic during like the early 2000s and there were those pants, the trip pants with like the big baggy pants and the chains and like, and I had this Slipknot shirt and I didn't shower. I was just like, I was disgusting, you know? So I was like, I'm going to change my look. I'm going to change everything, turn over a whole new leaf. And the first day I'm in that school, I'm getting high again. You know what I mean? And that's my story is I can't stay sober. I can't stay sober. I can't stay sober, you know? And, I'm on my fourth high school at this point. Right. We fast forward a little bit. I'm in this alternative school and, I'm attending intensive outpatient. Has anybody else ever tried intensive outpatient? Anybody? Any of you guys even alcoholics? Come on, guys. And they're telling me about my triggers and you know, like, and I remember like I'm sitting in this intensive outpatient with this counselor and we're doing my intake or whatever. And I'm telling her a little bit about my history and this, that, the other and the drugs I like to do. And like, I remember, like, she was like, look, you guys, we've had people like you in this program before. And she was like, you guys never stay sober. And I was like, oh, thanks. And that's encouraging. And she's like, so we give you guys 3 chances because we've never had one of you guys come in and just stay sober the whole time. And most of, even with the 3 chances, most of you guys don't complete the program, you know? Like I said, that was my story. I couldn't stay sober. I couldn't stay sober. So I'm trying to stay sober in this intensive outpatient and I'll get like, 6 days and then I'll drink and then I'll get 8 days and I'll get high, you know, I'm sitting in, I remember like the very, very last time I got high. I remember it like very clearly. It was June 9th, 2010. Right. It was like a beautiful June. I wake up. It's a beautiful June afternoon. I like to sleep late. And I can feel like the sunshine, like just like pouring in through the windows and it's like warm. And like, I remember like waking up and like thinking to myself that like everything is like fine. You know, like I got like this sobriety thing. Like I've kind of got it. I figured it out. And like, I'm going to be able to like just kind of get it this time, you know, and it's only a couple hours later that I'm window shopping in my parents' medicine cabinet, like a lot of us tend to do. And I find like a bottle of pills, you know, and I remember like exactly what ran through my mind when I pulled that bottle of pills out from the shelf. And I remember thinking to myself, well, I'm going to take one and it'll take the edge off, you know? So I pour one out and coincidentally, more than one falls out of the bottle. Who would have thought? So I remember. And so I'm like, all right, you know, I'll go on a little bender and I'll try the sobriety thing. When I come back, you know, I'll come back. And then I remember like pouring everything back in the bottle. I shut the lid and I run upstairs and I start sniffing and eating as many of these Xanax as I possibly can. Right. And I remember like very clearly thinking to myself, like, this very well, this is enough. You know what I mean? Like John and I were talking about it a little bit. And I remember thinking like, this is enough. You know, this, I could very well like not wake up from this. And then I remember thinking to myself, well, you know, as a matter of fact, I might be better off that way. And, you know, I always thought that, like, I got dealt, like, a really bad hand. And, like, the truth was I didn't. You know, I had, like, this beautiful shot at life. I'm 17 years old. And I'm, like, ready to die, you know? And I can't stay sober. And, like, everybody wants me to be sober but me. And I'm just, like, completely miserable, debilitatingly, crushingly depressed. And, you know, that's my story. And that's what, you know, drinking and getting high, like, that's where it takes me, you know? And, like, there was no party that day, you know? I did it because I had to get right. The longer I stay sober, the more miserable I become. So I wake up a couple days later and, I run outside and I smoke a cigarette and I come back in, and everybody in my family, they're all sitting in our living room in this circle. And it was really cute. You know, they had like their notes and their letters, and they wanted to play this game. It was called Intervention. I didn't want to play. And, I'll tell you what though, you know, they asked me, they said, can we take you to like a facility? And, I wanted to say no, but they told me that if they didn't, that they were going to cut me off and I wasn't going to have anywhere to stay. And, I don't do well, like on the streets. I don't do well in jail. You know what I mean? Like, so, and the truth of the matter was, I didn't say yes because like they were gonna, kick me out. I didn't say yes because of like any sort of like emotional appeal. I didn't say yes because of the letters that they wrote or the things that they said. Right. I said yes because like my back was against the wall and I was making another firm resolution. Right. And every bone in my body like told me that like I don't want to do this and I'm going to try to stay sober again. And like that's what I do when my back's against the wall, I'll do anything that you tell me to do. You know, when the heat comes on, I'm willing, you know what I mean? But it's a lot easier to move wet cement, you know, and as soon as like everything starts to kind of like work itself out and I start to build back up that house of cards, I'm not willing, you know, I'm not ready to go anywhere you tell me to go or do anything you tell me to do. It's not my story. So, I get in this rehab for a 7 to 10 day evaluation and I get out 4 months later. Right. And, it's so funny too. Cause like my dad, I was talking to my dad about this like not too long ago and we're talking a little bit about rehab. He found a letter that I wrote him and we're having like a really nice discussion about it. And I remember he told me, he was like, well, you know when they were going to let you out, right? And I was like, yeah, I remember that. He's like, I called them. He's like, I asked them to like let you stay a little bit longer. He was like, can't you just let him stay a little longer? They were like, no, we're done. We can't have him anymore. And they send me out to this sober house, right? And this is like one of my first experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember very, very vividly, right? And my first meeting was in that rehab. And I remember exactly what happened. They hand me the 9-step promises, right? And I start, and they say, can you read for us? And I say, okay. And I start to like read these 9-step promises. And here I am. My life is in shambles again. I'm completely broken. And I'm reading these promises and I'm starting to cry, right? And these tears are just like flowing down my face. I can't even get the words out, right? And it was actually like a really powerful experience for me because I remember thinking to myself, like, these promises are the answer to all of my problems. They know me, you know? At some point or another in Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to identify and that was the beginning of it. And I started to feel like there was some kind of hope, right? And so I get into this halfway house, and these people, they're all in AA, right? And they all come up to me, and they shake my hand, and they say, Greg, it's nice to meet you, and we're happy that you're here, and we hope you stick around. And they show me where the coffee is. And when I'm out of cigarettes, they give me a couple cigarettes, pat me on the butt, and tell me I'm going to be okay. You know, that was the first thing I remember about Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't remember what big book nugget somebody dropped in the meeting or anything like that. I couldn't even tell you what was said, but I do remember like how kind these people were to me and how happy they were that I was there. And, you know, I'm sitting in this sober house. It would have been like a really beautiful story if I just like did the 12 steps and started sponsoring guys immediately and like had this crazy spiritual experience. But like, you know, at some point or another, like opportunity and desperation had to meet. And, so I'm sitting in this halfway house, and I was probably the most popular guy in AA. I would do this. You guys used to love me. I would sit all the way in the back, right? And then I would wait in the open discussion meetings. If the meeting ended at 9, I would wait till 8:57, and I would share for like 8 minutes. And I was a demon, you know. And but you know what? You guys like kept like patting me on the butt and telling me like, please keep coming back. We're happy that you're here, you know, whether you hated me or not. you know, and I got a sponsor, and it's funny, I had had several other sponsors before this, but this guy in AA, right, he comes in and he's doing exactly what we're supposed to be doing, and he's coming to this halfway house, and he's talking to all the new people, you know, and he's trying to like share some hope from like art, from his heart to ours, and he's picking guys like me up, and he's taking us out to meetings, he's taking us on commitments, and he's taking us through the steps, and I remember like meeting this kid and like shaking his hand, and he's like, it's nice to meet you, and I'm like, and he's like, how you doing? And I'm like, I'm good, everything's good, everything's great. And he's like, no, you're not, you're fucking dying. Ooh, pardon my French. He's like, no, you're not, you're dying. He's like, look at where you are. You know, you can't tell me that you're happy here. And I'm like, no, I'm not, you know. And he's like, well, we're going to go to a meeting. Do you want to come with us? And I'm like, okay, you know. What if I said no? What if I had, like, somewhere better to be? You know, talk about seconds and inches. You know, there's another speaker that I really like, and he says, like, what if I said no? And it's like, it's true. What if I said no? I would have missed it all. And this guy, he brings me in the car with him, and on the way to the meeting, he's telling me a little bit of his story, and I'm telling him a little bit of mine. I'm starting to identify with this guy a little bit. And on the way back, we're listening to a speaker tape, and after the meeting, we hang out. You know, and he keeps telling me some of his story, and I start to like realize that like this guy, like I said, he has the same brand of crazy that I do, but he doesn't feel the way I'm feeling anymore. He's okay. Everything's okay for him. He's got like a great life, and he's got like this big smile on his face and this light on in his eyes. You know, like we talk about people with like the shiny eyes, and he was one of those people, you know, and he had an interest in helping me. And the only reason he wanted to help me is because he thought it would help him stay sober. And he was so on fire with this thing that he couldn't help but to give it away. You know, and I asked him to help me. I said, will you sponsor me? He said, yeah. And I said, okay, great. Do I call you every day? And he was like, please don't call me every day. You're nuts. But what he does is he drives 45 minutes each way, a couple times a week, to sit down and like share from his heart to mine, right? And like speak this like language of the heart and like share his experience and talk about his drinking and tell me his stories and talk about the steps and talk about the principles and talk about God. And like at first I wasn't having it, but all I knew was like this guy, like he had something that like I wanted so bad. He was okay, you know, and I certainly wasn't. And he starts to take me through the steps, and I'm like, what do I do? Do I fill out a paper for like my first step? I know I did a couple of those in rehab. And he was like, no, you don't need to do that, dude. He's like, you're here, you know, you don't need to fill out like some kind of like a packet or a booklet or anything like that. He's like, do you think I have the same brand of crazy as you do? And I'm like, absolutely, you know? And he's like, do you think that like whatever's happened to me could like maybe possibly some kind of slim chance happen to you? And I'm like, well, I don't know, I guess. I did, you know, that was the reason I was hanging out with this guy. You know, he wasn't buying me cigarettes or buying my meals or anything like that. Like I was hanging out with him because I wanted him to help me. And he said, okay. He said, well, this is the first decision, probably the most important decision you'll ever make, right? And he's talking about our third step decision. And what he explains to me very clearly is that like God's going to be the father and I'm going to be the child. He's the principal and I'm the agent, right? And all I have to do, right, is go out and do his work well and everything will be taken care of for me, right? And we get to this prayer, and like he said, the wording was quite optional, right? And he starts to explain to me that like all it means is like, hey, God, if you're up there, if there's something, if you're out there somewhere, you know, I'm maybe like a little bit willing to like try this thing, and I'm gonna do for a little bit, I'm gonna do whatever this guy does, and I'm gonna go wherever he goes, and if something happens to me, right, in this like slim chance that like something very well could happen to me, I'm gonna share it with other people. That's it. I'm gonna do for other people what Dan's doing for me. And that was my first sponsor. His name was Dan. And so we get on our knees and we say this prayer. And I remember like I was telling him, because I had other sponsors before, right? And I remember telling him like, Dan, I've already done a third step. Like, can't we just, like, skip this one? Next, come on, man. And he was like, no, you haven't. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, if you had really done a third step, we wouldn't be having this discussion right now, and I wouldn't need to help you. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. And then he was like, shut up, I don't want what you have anyways. And so I say, okay, right? And he helps me get started on my fourth step, and I start to, like, write this list of, like all these people and all these relationships and all these selfish, dishonest, self-seeking things that I had done. And I start to, like, write out this list, and it doesn't take me that long, you know? And, like, I've had the chance to sponsor a couple guys these days, and I'll always ask them, I'll be like, how long did it really take you to write your fourth step? And I'll always get the same exact answer, whether it takes them a week, whether it takes them a month, whether it takes them a year, whether it takes them a day. When you collect all the time that it took them to write their fourth steps, myself included, might take about 2 hours, hour and a half, 2 hours. You know, you're not talking about a novel here. And so I write this fourth step and I write it quickly. And like we start to, and I call him and I'm like, all right, I'm done. What do I do now? And he's like, I'll be over in 45 minutes. And he comes and he picks me up and he brings me back to his house and we sit across his kitchen table, right? And we have like a long talk. And he starts to say things like to me like, don't you think you could be like afraid of like being alone? Or being wrong. Starts to say things like, you kind of see like where you're being selfish. And a couple times he even said, like, that's the most selfish thing I've ever freaking heard. And, you know, at some point or another, like, I identified a little bit more and I started to realize, like maybe my perception wasn't exactly right, you know? And I walk away from this discussion and I realize that, like, there's all these, like, terrible, like, just completely messed up relationships, these burnt bridges in my life. And the common denominator in all of them is me. And I realize that, like, something really needs to change, right? He sends me home, and we read the big book, and we read, like, steps 6 and 7. And I go, and I find a place where I can be alone for an hour, right, and be quiet for an hour. And I start to, like, go through the first 5 proposals, and at that point, like, my third step decision, it really made sense, you know, and I knew that something was happening to me, and I knew that all I had to do was just share it with other people, and everything would be okay. And as soon as I started doing that, I just want to say everything from that point to this has worked out in my life. And, like, even in the, like, early on when I was just, like, kind of, like, running around and I was starting to catch on fire with this thing, you know, like, all I was focused on was, like, how can I, like, be of service in AA? How can I find the new guy and, like, help him? And like, I got a car that just fell into my lap. I didn't have to pay for. I had a roof over my head and food in my belly. I got out of the halfway house into a, like, a beautiful apartment. The crazy ex-girlfriend came back, even though she was totally nuts. And, you know, and at some point or another, like, I'm living in Scranton. My parents, my dad gives me a call and he says, you know, your stepmom's sick and we'd really like to have you back here. You know, this is the same guy that told me if I don't leave, he's going to make me leave, you know? And it's just, like, such a beautiful thing. So, like, during this hour, like, I start to, like, feel something happening to me, right? And I couldn't, like, put it into words, you know, but I start to, like, realize that, like, I need to change. And I start to, like, I'm beginning to have this spiritual experience that we talk about in our big book. And I find something in that hour, right, that I would later find in AA over and over again. And it was something I was looking for in the bottom of bottles and in the bottom of bags my entire life. And I chase that, you know, I'm an excessive person and I tend to chase things and I tend to do things to excess. So I might as well do AA to excess. You know, it's really, I heard somebody say it was the bigger, badder buzz, as corny as that sounds. That's something I believe in my heart. So, we get to like this, eight step list. And he tells me that I already written it because I wrote a fourth step and there were all these people that I had like completely destroyed. And he sends me out to go make some amends, right? And I just want to talk like very briefly on a couple, maybe one or two amends stories. There was this girl, right? And we had known each other a long time, probably since we were like 11 or 12 years old. And we used to run around together and get high together, right? Her name was Abby. And when I go to get sober, her and I kind of like go our separate ways, right? And at some point or another, I'm maybe like 3 years sober and she gives me a call. 2 or 3 years sober, and she gives me a call, and she says, Greg, I'm sober. And I'm like, oh, my God, that's great. And she, you know, she was a little hard up, and she went to, like, some kind of treatment facility. She comes back. She's sober. She's trying to stay sober. She's new. And I'm like, all right, I'll be right over. And I pick her up, right? And we start to like, and like I had owed this girl amends for like a long time. I stole a carton of cigarettes from her. And, so on the way down, I go and I pick up a carton of cigarettes, Marlboro Menthol, and I hand them to her when I see her. And I'm like, listen, like, and like, whatever I said, like the words like are really, I don't think that the words are as important as like what happens when we really make an amends, when we really try to like kind of balance the scales out just a little bit in the other direction. Right. And, so I hand her this carton of cigarettes and we go out and we start hitting meetings together in Alcoholics Anonymous. Right. And like, just like Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a real shot at life, I got a chance to like kind of take her around and like help her to like have a shot, you know. And I introduced her to a bunch of women that could sponsor her, and I took her around to all the different meetings. We got a chance to go meet all the different people. And in doing that, what we're really doing, I think, is we're trying to like help each other. We're helping each other grow spiritually by finding ways to be of service together. And so we're running around AA, and maybe like a week or two into it, I get a phone call from her aunt. And I'm just getting ready to go to work, and her aunt, she's just like bawling on the phone. She's crying. I'm like, what's up? And she's like, Abby got high last night and she didn't wake up. And so I you know, you take a situation like that, right? You take a relationship like that, and you take like a completely just like burnt bridge, and you get a chance to like kind of like balance the scales out. And like, my guess is that if you were to ask her in like those final moments, like, what about that guy, Greg? You know, if you had asked her like 6 weeks before that, she would have told you that I was a total scumbag and that she never wanted anything to do with me again. Right. And I'm sure that she would have told you, like, if you asked her, like, did you really benefit from having this guy in your life? She would have been able to say yes, you know? And I think that's like the real amends. And I show up to this funeral, and I wear a tie, and I look sharp, and I look like something's happened, and I show up, and I'm there with one purpose. I'm not there so I can try and suck the life out of the room. I'm there so I can try and be of service, right? And try to find ways to be helpful to the family and to the friends. And I see all my old friends, right? And see a lot of them, and a lot of them aren't doing so good, right? And I get to show them that there's like a little bit of hope. I get to sit down with a couple of them, and I get to like tell them a little bit of my story. And like every now and then I'll get a call from one of those guys, and we'll go out and I'll try and help them. You know, I've made amends to like, I mean, I've definitely like made a lot of amends. Other one is like, I made amends to my mom. Right. And like what I told her, like, once again, like the words, I think they're like not as important, because all I could really get out this time when I made amends to my mom was mom. And then she starts crying, and she gives me a big bear hug, and the next words out of my mouth, they're like, you're crushing my ribs, please. And like, you know, you fast forward a little bit, and like, I have this good job and I'm sober. I've been sober for a little bit, and our appliances in our house, they start to like kind of crap out, and we need new appliances, and like, she can't afford it. And I'm coming in on this like really big bonus check. So I hand her a $3,000 check, and I say, is that enough? Or if you need more, I can get it for you in 2 weeks. You know, like, that's like the real amends. Like, what kind of action am I taking to try and balance out the scales just a little bit in the other direction? The funny thing about like being delusional is like, you don't know you're in it when you're in it. And that's like part of like the beautiful thing about having like a home group and a network of like strong people that like, and that you're really close to and you see all the time, is like, you know, when I start to fall back into that delusion, somebody can grab me and just kind of pull me out. Somebody can grab me and be like, dude, that's like the most selfish thing I've ever heard. What's wrong with you? You know? And, as far as prayer and meditation, you know, like I was always told that like the best place to start, like when I was new, like people would, cause I would hear all this stuff about like all these different kinds of like prayer and meditation to like kind of like improve our spiritual lives in AA. And what I was told is like the best place to start are pages 86 through 88 in the big book, right? And there are clear instructions on what you do in the morning and what you do at night, right? So I wake up in the morning and I say, God, I'm clocking in today. Where do you want me to go? Apparently today he wanted me to come out to Quakertown, you know? And at night I say, like, where can I do better? You know? And I just follow those instructions. And like, I've delved into like all sorts of like different kinds of like spiritual approaches. But it's always in addition to, never in place of, you know? And if I ever start doing that stuff in place of, instead of in addition to, our 12th step, I know that like I'm heading down the wrong path. And, you know, being able to be a part of like this, like I said, like I've fallen in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, and being able to like be a part of like this movement, of, like helping drunks, is like one of the best things, probably the best thing that's like ever happened to me. And it's like such a beautiful thing that we get to like sit down and like share one-on-one with other alcoholics when nobody's looking but God, and like, transfer some heart from like my heart, some hope from my heart to their hearts. And like sometimes people stay sober and sometimes they don't, you know. There was a kid, I was speaking out in somewhere else in the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania, and, no offense, sorry guys. And we're at this Wawa, and I'm sitting in the car with two guys that I sponsor, and one of these guys has to go in, and they have to get a pack of cigarettes, right? And they go, and there's this guy, he's panhandling outside of the Wawa, right? He's trying to get up 10 bucks so he can buy a bag of dope. And I turned to like my friend Matt, and I'm like, dude, why don't you like go talk to that guy? He looks like he's like really sick. So he goes up to him and he starts talking to him, and he starts to share his story with this guy. The guy's name was Drew. And we're like, dude, when's the last time you've been to a meeting? And he's like, a what? And we're like, a meeting, dude, come on. And, he's like, I don't have a problem. And he's got like a black eye, and you can see the track marks on his arm. His glasses are broken. And we're like, all right, dude, well, we're going to go if you want to come with us, just get in the car. And he comes and he jumps in the car with us, you know, and we take him out to this meeting, and he gets to like be a part of AA, and he gets to go out and meet some people and like experience some kind of like hope. And we take him out to another meeting after that, right? And then we take him back to the last stop in Kensington. He throws out all of his needles on the way there, and you know, we take him in, and he's like shaking and he's scared, and like we take him through the steps, right? And like over the course of like just a couple short weeks, this guy starts to like transform, you know, and he starts showering, and he starts to like, he cuts his hair, and all of a sudden he starts running around the last stop, and he's sponsoring all these guys on the last stop. And he's all excited, and he's, like, enthusiastic about sobriety, you know? And, like, that's, like, just, like, one of the most unbelievable things, you know? And, like, when I had my first drink with Casey, like I said, it was like we were brothers, you know? And, like, when I get to pick up guys like that and, like, have that experience, right? You can't do this with somebody else and not, like, just, like, become, like, best friends with them. And, like, Drew and I are, like, brothers today. So we're, I have, like, these amazing people. Matt and I are like, brothers, and it's, like, such a beautiful thing. And, you know, you fast forward a little bit, and here I am. I'm 4 years sober, and I'm standing in front of all you people, like, telling my story, and I never thought I would be here, you know? And I never thought I would stay sober, you know? And I thought if I was lucky, I would be working at McDonald's or something. I don't know. No offense if anybody works at McDonald's. And today, like, I go to school. I had my first day of classes today, and I go to school at LaSalle University in Philadelphia, and I absolutely love it, you know. And I do okay, and I make friends, and I get decent grades, and I'm not the kid who picks his nose and like eats his boogers anymore. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know, man. It's like such a beautiful thing, and like this group, like we're having Bob Darrell out. We'd love to see all you guys there, and it's like such an exciting thing, and. You know, I have, like, great relationships with my parents today. And, you know, it's so funny because, like, every now and then, well, my dad used to, like, go on vacation and leave me at his house with no money and, like, 10 pizzas in the fridge. You know what I mean? Like, the guy didn't want anything to do with me. And today, like, we have, like, such a beautiful relationship together. And, like, we go out and we hang out together, and, like, I can spend the day with him, and, like, we'll go out to dinner, and, like, instead of thinking about, like, when I can leave so I can go get high, like, I can just kind of sit there and, like, enjoy his company. And he's, like, my best friend today, you know, and so is my mom. And, like, I have all these, like, wonderful, just, like, completely amazing hosts of friends. You know, I go to a great school, drive a car that runs. I've got a license, insurance, all that jazz. You know, I'm not medicated. It's just unbelievable, you know. And if you asked me 4 years ago where I thought I would be, I would have completely sold myself short. You know, because I'm not a guy who can stay sober. I'm not. You know, it took somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous to come in and to like scoop me up and save my life. You know, and I think back to like being in that halfway house and like how I could have said no. You know, and I could have missed it all. Thank you.